Welcome to Coaching Conversations, a weekly discussion of topics related to coaching and sport of volleyball at all levels. I'm your host, John Foreman, author of the CoachingVB.com blog and co-developer of the Volleyball Coaching Wizards Project. Let's dive right in. Welcome to episode 13 of the podcast, and happy new year to 2021. It's January 3rd as I record this, which means it is the first episode in the new year for patrons. But for those of you who are not patrons, you've already had one. Episode 12 would have dropped today. So happy weekend to the new year for those of you. If you follow the blog, you'll know that I put up a post discussing what I was, you know, kind of a look back on 2020 and a bit of a look forward to 2021. Not a huge one because there's still a massive amount of uncertainty. It was more of a kind of a reflection than anything else. Personally, I'm, you know, kind of thinking about what I want 2021 to bring, aside from lots more volleyball than we had in 2020. I think that's pretty much a given for most, if not all of us at that point. It's still too early for me to know what the season's going to be with the Madai teams. Aside from the fact that we know that the women's team, having been pushed from fall to spring, won't have a conference season per se this year. The conference announced that before Christmas. Teams will be allowed to play on an ad hoc sort of basis with constraints, but there won't actually be a conference season this year. I don't know what that's specifically going to mean for us at Madai. I'll be talking with the administration about that and how we want to handle it. To this point, the expectation is still that we're going to have a men's season. The conference has been very strong in its conviction from going back to August and probably even earlier that for the spring sports that had their seasons cut short last year, they want to give them the opportunity to have a season this year as much as they possibly can. So the conference already posted a revised schedule for the men, which will start on March 13th. It'll be a single round robin, which is a different format than normal. Obviously, it'll be fewer matches. There is room to add in some non-conference matches. So we'll see what that looks like, again, with some certain constraints. Like I said, there's a lot of uncertainty and we still got to figure out what it's all going to look like at the end of the day. And, you know, here's hoping that as we progress through the winter and more people are getting the vaccine and we head toward warmer weather, you know, the impact of COVID will be reduced. But what that exactly is going to play out to be is anybody's guess at this point. And for me, lots of things on my to-do list, as always. Some of them maybe I'll get to, and some of them I probably won't. But in which case, they'll just get be pushed back to another time. That's sort of my life. I always have a million things to do and nowhere near enough time to do all of that sort of stuff. One of these days, I'll have a staff or something, and I can start assigning things and getting other people to pursue my crazy ideas. But anyway, for now, this episode I've got with me Tim Alanese, who is a former colleague of mine. We were assistant coaches together at Midwestern State. That's in an NCAA Division II school in North Texas, Wichita Falls. We also worked together for a year at Charleston Academy, which is a new juniors program in Charleston, South Carolina at that point. Tim is now coaching at an NAIA school in Kansas. This is his first year doing that. He's also coaching a juniors program in the Wichita area of Kansas. And he's been involved with juniors coaching for a long, long time. He was doing it when we were at Midwestern. And as I said, when we were at Charleston together, also doing it there. So the topic we have, you know, for this conversation is something that when I kind of threw at him the question of what are some topics that, you know, could become interesting conversations. I think I sent this to him like back in August or something like that. One of the ones that jumped out was Can you be competitive with kids, with athletes who aren't inherently motivated to win the way you might, I don't know, stereotype, expect, envision, or to put it another way, can a team full of players whose first priority is not winning and losing be a successful team? So we kind of chew on that and throw some ideas back and forth. I would love to hear your thoughts on this. I'm not sure we entirely reached a conclusion, so there's a lot of room for different ideas and opinions and feedback, and maybe this will branch into a second discussion or a series of conversations on this subject. I'm perfectly willing to pursue it. It's, as you'll kind of hear in this exchange, it's something that I have thought about before, going back a few years. And I've got my own thoughts on it. Tim's got his thoughts on it, but I'm sure other people do too. So, feel free to leave a comment on the blog post or drop me a line or post on social media, whatever suits your fancy. So with that, let's get into the conversation, and I hope you find it interesting. Why don't you define, because I know you had a very specific idea. Because I know exactly when we were talking about this. So define what you mean when you say care about the experience. I mean, this will obviously get into the discussion of competition and stuff. But what we mean by the experience of the athlete is kind of important to this, I think.
Everything from when you choose to be a part of an athletic program and a part of a team, a feedback you hear a lot from the players is they're looking for a connectedness, they're looking for a family, they're looking for an atmosphere. They want obviously some sort of a structure, but also just the whole experience of being a student athlete, of being on a team, of being a part of something bigger than themselves. And I think you run across the players where that matters to them a great deal. And I think you could argue that there's players where that matters to them more than the specific win-loss record of the team as a whole, is that overall experience. I think you see teams that can have a winning record, and you hear about this from coaches all the time, but like, yeah, that season sucked. Whether that's drama with the players, whether that's based on decisions the coaches made, and what they felt was necessary to win, and it just the whole team just struggled with that, and you see, just obviously not everything is sunshines and roses in athletics, but I think sometimes the experience is made a lot more difficult than it needs to be. When we ignore a significant number of the players who would like to just have a better overall experience. I don't know if I defined the experience for you in that rambling statement.
Well, yeah,
It's fine.
I have a pretty good sense for it. We'll just wonder if we'll just see if the listeners do. I mean, you definitely hear it in the recruiting side of things where you talk to a kid about what do they want? What is it they want out of being a student athlete? And a lot of them do bring up, I want to be connected with my teammates. I want to have enjoy my 4 years, make close friends. And a lot of them really don't talk about the volleyball all that much, which I'm sure to some coaches is a completely horrifying thought. Like, wait, what? You don't care if we win or lose? It's not that they don't care. We have to put that out there first.
It's just
It's
not
not that they
their
don't
number one
care.
priority.
Exactly. And it's kind of like when you talk to people about job satisfaction, very few people put how much they get paid as the top thing on their list. There's a whole bunch of other things that go ahead of that.
And I think that's a great analogy. And for whatever reason, I don't always see that perception from the head coaching side of things, as far as because a lot of times the job's on the line, right? So winning matters.
Yeah, they're there is at least the perception of a conflict there by the head coach or the coaching staff. It's like, well, wait, we're paid to win. The athletic director, the president of the college, the alumni, the boosters, they want us to win. But these kids don't care. You know, it's kind of that old classic phrase about, you know, my career prospects are beholden to the whims of 18 to 22 year olds, which is, you know, a kind of a horrifying prospect for a lot of people. But the thing that makes this an interesting conversation for me is the idea that it ties in with the whole competitiveness conversation. Where you see coaches ask us, how do I make my kids more competitive? My kids aren't competitive enough, blah, 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 all these sorts of things. And there's a lot of discussion of, you know, how do we make drills more competitive? How do we make more competition in practice? And there's something ways to do that, and we don't need to get into that conversation right here. But I think it's a really interesting intellectual exercise to think about, well, what does being competitive really mean? Most people, I think, will tie it to winning and losing. Did I win or lose the drill? But I think it's actually more nuanced than that. And part of that comes from my experience coaching overseas, not necessarily with the teams I had at the time when I started thinking about this, but with the situation I was going into before I started coaching in Sweden. This guy, Simon Loftus, and I had this conversation, and Simon did one of the earlier coaching conversations that I'll put a link in. He had coached in Sweden for, I don't know if it was a couple of years or a year or however long his tenure was. And I guess kind of the feedback he got coming out of it was that the perception of him was too competitive as a coach. He was too competitive, implying that, I don't know if it was coming from the team or the organization or what, but clearly implying that there was other priorities that whoever was making these judgments felt were higher. And he actually thought there was a cultural element to it in the Swedish population and their attitude towards sport. And we never got into this huge discussion about it, but it did make me start thinking about, okay, well, if you're not concerning yourself with the absolute of winning and losing, can you still think of competition in a different light? Is there still a sense of competition just in a kind of another context that a lot of people don't necessarily think about it? I mean, you've coached a lot of club teams where, yeah, winning and losing is a nice thing, but it's not your main focus.
Right.
You know, how does that sort of mentality reflect to you?
Well, it's interesting because some of the best athletes that I've coached, some of the most driven athletes that I've coached, yes, they were competitive and they wanted their team to win. But in practice, it's not that they were competing with each other, if that makes sense. Like they weren't. And because sometimes you see this drive sometimes from coaches to want to make the athletes individually competitive, right? Mm-hmm. Hey, find whoever made an error and pull them out of the drill. And you're not going to be the one to make an error. And so now I'm grabbing my own teammates, you know, and as for some of the female athletes that I've coached, they have a hard time with that. But the coaches justify it. They're like, yeah, you're teaching them to be competitive. And you're like, yeah, but now they're competing individually rather than with each, using their teammates as their partners to compete against the opposing team. And like I said, some of the best athletes that I've ever coached, they just loved playing the game. These kids would come home from a club tournament and they'd 3 hours through the snow and they'd be out in the front yard playing one-on-one volleyball in the snow because they couldn't get enough volleyball. Now,
okay, wait.
I would need to have a conversation
when,
with them.
You ever coach kids who dealt with 3 hours in the snow?
Listen, I know it doesn't snow a lot in Texas. I know that. But the one time it happened, snow.
The end of a
2-day tournament, and these athletes have been playing all weekend, and they came home, and I get video of the kids playing one-on-one in the front yard. And I don't know that that was necessarily because they were competitive by the traditional sense, so much as they loved playing the game. And now I do think they were competitive athletes, but I don't know that they fit. Or maybe I don't know that our drive to make our players competitive on an individual level would be as beneficial as a drive to get the athletes to want to work with their team.
Yeah, and I think that speaks to things like rankings. Mm-hmm. In individual level rankings, which is where, you know, like competitive cauldron comes into play, and
right,
and how that potentially gets used. And I know back in the day, there was a lot of talk about it could be used from a ranking perspective, possibly to determine playing time sort of thing. But it sounds like these days people have gotten away from doing that. Even people who are strong advocates for doing a cauldron don't advocate using it to decide playing time, and don't necessarily use it to rank players per se, putting them individually competitive against each other. And I think it makes a lot of sense because probably less so on the, this is getting a little bit stereotypical, but it's my experience, and I'm guessing others have had it as well. The guys are much happier being one-on-one competitive. It seems second nature to them. Whereas on the women's side, well, you certainly do have female athletes who are competitive in that way. A lot of them are reluctant to go that route with their teammates.
Right.
Because they value the relationship. And they perceive
right
something that would put one above the other as problematic in that light. So it speaks to your point. Well, you can still be competitive within a broader context, okay, in an inclusive way instead of in an exclusive way.
Right. And I think that, I mean, obviously, your players are individuals and they're different, and you've got to look at this adjustment, but I think that's one of the reasons that prompted this question for me is I just, and this might just be biased based on my experience, but I see a lot of coaches pushing the athletes that they perceive as non-competitive to try to be individually competitive in practice. And my thought is, I mean, okay, why aren't they individually competitive? Is it because they are, you know, team oriented, right? And if that's the case, then I don't know that pushing them to be individually competitive will get the best out of that athlete versus figuring out what drives them and talking to them about that. If I could sit an athlete down who is all about the connection and the relationship and show them how changing a behavior or an attitude towards a certain drill and practice will help their teammates, I feel like I am going to get a lot more out of that conversation because I'm appealing to what's in their nature, which is the connectedness, talking about helping their teammates, than I would if I were just sit there and say, listen, I need you to win this drill more.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I'm thinking back to a setter we both coached at Midwestern.
He also came to mind for me.
Yeah. And it was, in her case, it was, I think we can argue it was a little bit different.
Sure.
In that she didn't necessarily think that winning or losing was unimportant. She was failing to recognize what the point of what we were trying to do was.
Right.
You know, we were giving her opportunities to do things to be able to set her team up to win, but she wasn't doing them, and so she was losing all the time. Right.
And that's the type of individual where just that sort of communication and relating it back to the team as a whole, I think, makes a big difference.
Yeah, and I find myself thinking about, you know, games and stuff that happen in practice. and how I, you know, you get them playing like a game that we've used, you know, which is, we call it Brazilian, but you know, it's two ball bagger tennis, as they would call it in Europe, two ball, two player. And the way we played it a lot in the gym was two teams, you know, you'd split the squad up and you'd have two teams, and yeah, there'd only be two players on the court at a time, but you're playing for your team. Right. And there was as much trash talking during those games.
Exactly. And that's the kind of like where you have a team, and I think it's a healthy competition. Even it's still in our squad, but you get it a little bit away from the individual level, and you get it at a bit more of a team level, and they get really competitive.
Yeah. And it's fun to watch. I mean, they're into it. You know, the intensity level goes up. They're having fun, which is always good. They're relaxed about it. The competition isn't 1v1. It's okay, my group against your group, and it's not me against you. It's all of us against all of you.
Right.
Which is safer. You know, there's less individual exposure in that regard.
There is less individual exposure, and it gives them that sense of connectedness for those players that are looking for that. Mm-hmm. And I've often wondered if we don't overemphasize the individual competitive side.
Yeah. Yeah. It is an interesting point.
And I could be wrong. I mean, maybe it is incredibly important, but I would be really curious to see how things worked out for a team that handled that differently.
Well, one of the interesting things that Mike Hebert wrote about, and I think it was his second book, which is based on when he was coaching in Illinois, he kind of described different types of players. And one of them was competitor. You need a certain number of competitors in the team. Others were more like glue players, and I forget, there's three or four different categories.
Right.
And each team needs, you know, combinations of those to make it run well. And I haven't read that book in a long time. It was something I read very early in my coaching career. But he did make the point that you need at least one really good competitor in your team. And it's probably best if it's your center. I think it was kind of the message he was making. And his argument was a very, very reasonable one. But it does beg the question in this context that we're having is, are those individuals individually competitive, or are they competitive in the team context, driving the team to win? What would that look like in the gym in a 1v1 sort of drill of some sort or competition of some kind versus a 4v4 or 6-on-6 or something along those lines? That would be interesting to see.
Yes, definitely.
This whole idea of individual versus group is I wonder if there's any sort of research or literature out there on that. Maybe that's just the geek in me that's asked that question. But I do wonder how much people have kind of given it thought, whether it's conscious or unconscious. You know, how much is it a drive to win for me to be the best versus a drive for my team to be the best?
Right.
And is one better than the other? On the face of it, I would argue in a team sport, yeah, one's better than the other. It shouldn't be about individual glory. And I bet if we had Mark Lebedew on here, he would have some comments at that point as well. Because he definitely has some ideas on players who care more about them being the ones that are the reason for their team winning versus their team winning. Mm-hmm. So a player that his team won, but he had a bad day, cares more about the fact that he had a bad day than about the team winning. Yeah. Or Yeah, it's just obviously you got to care about both to a certain degree, but yeah, it's the interesting character aspect of things. So what are your thoughts on this, having the experience versus winning? Can kids who are more interested in the experience win?
I think so. I think the answer is yes.
I would tend to agree.
I think that they learn to be competitive along the way because they love playing the game. And the more that you love playing the game, and I think as you play, you get to be competitive. But then you get them outside of that game situation, and they're no longer competitive people. And they put on their persona of competitiveness within the team context, within we're gonna fight to help the team win, and I think you can win with that. Will you be consistently number one? I don't know the answer to that. I think you can be good, and I think you can win with kids like that. Can you be the absolute number one? I don't know.
That's kind of the question, isn't it? Do you need to have a bunch of quote-unquote winners on your team to be national champion or whatever it is?
I think the answer is no. I think the answer is, if we're talking national champion level, you need a few. Like Mike Hebert said, you need a couple. You need some competitors. But I don't think you need a whole team of them. And I think you do the other players a disservice when you try to make them all that way rather than playing to what they're good at. Yes, you can obviously work on, if you have a non-competitive kid learning but non-competitive doesn't mean they're not a hard worker. They just don't have the same perception of winning or losing.
Right. Yeah.
Where the head coach is way more upset at a loss than the players. And the coach might be actually a little angry that the players aren't more angry about the loss.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of what prompted this conversation is like, it's not that the kids don't care. It's just that they also value other things.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then the coach just, it's a different mental process.
Mm-hmm.
And to my mind, a situation like that is a failure of the coach to recognize what the players value, what they prioritize. I mean, at the core of our job as coaches is we got to connect with these athletes to understand how they work individually and then also understand how they work collectively. And if we're projecting ourselves on them, we're not going to get the job done. You know, everybody's just going to end up being miserable. Mm-hmm. I think it was one of the volleyball coaching wizards who said that you can't expect your players to be you. They're not you. They're never going to be you. Even if you recruit kids that are close to you, they're still not you. And you know, I've definitely seen plenty of coaches who go into it. They don't do it intentionally, obviously. But you have conversations with them. It's like, why don't they want to spend another 2 hours in the gym? Why don't they want to kill themselves to go get that ball over there? Why don't they move as fast? Why don't they see what I see? Well, chances are because you've seen a lot more than they have. And so they haven't developed that skill yet. But it's one of those things. It's part of the equation of why elite performers oftentimes don't make particularly great coaches. It's because it's hard for them to recognize in others that they're not the same as you. They're not going to be able to do the things that you did, especially when you're talking about an experience gap.
And that's where I'm always impressed with the ones that are great coaches who can separate what they did and their competitiveness as a player and just focus on helping the athletes. When you see that in action, I think that's a pretty neat thing.
Yeah, I was literally just last night watching a thing on Netflix. I think it was called Take the Ball, Pass the Ball. It was about Barcelona soccer. And Johan Cruyff is a legendary figure in world soccer as a player. He was one of the best ever. And then he goes and takes over Barcelona, and he's one of the best coaches ever. Takes Barcelona from basically nothing to being a world powerhouse. And you don't see that an awful lot. And anyway, that's a divergence. the question that always comes to my mind is, if we can't make kids be competitive in the standard winning and losing definition of competitiveness, and they aren't inherently there already, you can make arguments about what you can do there. How can we still have them be competitive without it being a question of raw winning and losing? How can we make them want to win or to value winning without it just being simply about the winning? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think you can take pride in skills. You know, hey, we're going to outpass them. Or maybe not even outpass them. Hey, we're going to be the best passing team in the league. We're going to be the best serving team in the league. Maybe you pick something that they love doing, especially if you have a lot of them that enjoy doing it. And you make that your thing. We're going to be great servers. You know, maybe you have a couple really good servers in the gym, and it's not that big of a stretch for you to imagine you being the best serving team in the league. And you just come back and you make that a set of like team pride issue. Hey, we're going to be the best serving team in the league. I think we've got some solid servers. And I mean, you get them on board there. Now they're going into a match and they're sitting there thinking, hey, we're going to be the best serving team here. And I mean, that's going to go a long way to you winning and losing right there if you're out serving everybody in the league. But from the team perspective, they're just focusing on being the best servers they can be.
Right. Yeah. I want to take it even further than that, though, because you're still there expressing a direct competitiveness thing.
Sure.
Because presumably you've got some sort of metric that you're saying, okay, we score higher than anybody else. So we win in terms of serving.
Sure. Yeah. No, you're right. I did.
Which is fine. I mean, it essentially takes it from being an outright result sort of context to a more of a process sort of context, whereas you can kind of break that competitive netness down into bits and pieces. We want to be the best serving team. We want to be top half in blocking. Whatever.
I'll give you an example that I think I've given you before, and you tell me if you feel like it's applicable to the situation. Had a club team, 15s. This was several years ago. I didn't pick up on it, but my assistant, she had a really good eye. The girls were being real pouty when the game wasn't going their way, and she said, "Tim, you're letting them pout." I said, "You're right." And this was relatively deep into the season. So I brought them together. They were a pretty self-aware group. I said, "Look around. What do you see? What's on the faces?" And they were pretty self-honest, and they admitted to that. Like, "Hey, we're just sad. We're just depressed because we lost." I said, "Okay." And so we changed our focus to just to work as hard as you could. And if you could go back and change anything about the game, we're not talking winning or losing. We're talking about the effort that you gave. Would you? And I just started asking those two questions at the end of practices. And we only had, we actually only had one more tournament. So for 3 weeks of practice, we asked that question at the end of every practice. Hey, did you work as hard as you could? Would you change anything? My starting setter broke her finger in that last tournament. So I was missing her for our regional qualifier. And so we lost in a playoff set to go to the bid round on the second day for the NTR. And so we just went silver bracket and we ended up winning the silver bracket. And they played amazing, phenomenal the whole weekend. And they came up to me at the end of the tournament and I didn't ask. They were all like, coach, 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 coach. we worked as hard as we could and we wouldn't change anything. And so that conversation, we never addressed winning or losing. We never addressed anything that I would necessarily even describe as competitive other than, hey, just work as hard as you could. Mm-hmm. And the result was the best volleyball I'd ever seen them play.
Yeah, I think it goes in the direction of the prodding that I'm kind of giving you here. But the thought process that I'm trying to work toward is being competitive in the context of performance of what you're doing, of pursuing excellence. I think that's probably the best way to put it.
Okay.
You're seeking to put out the best performance that you can all the time to essentially be a better performer than the other team. You may or may not win or lose, because, I mean, if they're just better than you, then they're just better than you. But that doesn't mean you still can't outperform them relative to your capabilities. And I'm not saying that that's exactly, you know, the idea here, but the thought process that came into my mind when I was having that conversation with Simon was, well, what if the competitiveness is about being our best, developing to the best extent possible in a lot of those things that certainly contribute to winning and losing, but are not things that are ever going to show up on the scoreboard. So it's more of a kind of a satisfaction with what you're doing and how you're going about doing things than it is tied with, we won the trophy, we didn't win the trophy, what place we finished in the league, you know, that sort of thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think that's pretty similar to what was happening there with that team that I had. It may not be the same, but not too far apart.
So the question then becomes, for somebody who's in this, well, winning and losing are all that matters, and that's how we define competitiveness. Your team didn't win, Tim.
No, they didn't.
If those kids were really focused on winning and losing, would they have done better or worse?
I think they would have done worse personally.
I mean, yeah, based on...
Because I think by shifting the focus from winning and losing to just their own effort, they were able to take a level of stress off of them and play a lot better volleyball than they had been. I think being down the starting setter was going to keep us from winning that tournament, but we'll see.
Yeah. And the argument, pushback you get on that as well. Okay. Then you obviously didn't have a bunch of players who were driven to win. Or did you? That would be a really interesting question. I mean, if you could have assessed them at some point along the way and rated how competitive they were in that regard, and then compared it to, well, how did they perform when we only focused on winning and losing versus when we were focusing on things that really weren't about winning and losing?
Right. I don't know. That would be interesting.
Yeah. It's a sort of experiment you could never conduct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, what, it's unlikely you would take two different teams. I mean, you're never going to have two teams that are exactly identical that you could put them in, you know, in a little lab and go, okay, this team, we're just going to talk about winning and losing.
Right.
And this team, we're just going to talk about, you know, putting in your best performance.
I was thinking about that just in the broader context of technique and coaching theory in general. Mm-hmm. Is it can be really hard to determine what exactly is making the difference. And I feel like just having a structured system helps a ton, right? You don't know that it's necessarily the most efficient system, but it helps. Whether that even, you know, getting away from this conversation slightly, whether you're talking blocked versus random training, I just coming in and having a system that the players buy into, I think is big in helping them get better. But I was thinking about that part the other day, just the measuring part. Sorry, that's what prompted this side thought was like, is there really a way to measure it on an individual team would be difficult.
Yeah, I mean, people might throw out something like a DISC assessment or something along those lines where you might tease out some of that. I don't know if that really gets there or not. I'm trying to pull up something because this actually, I just recently was having a chat with Mark on this subject. And we're kind of debating the idea of exactly what you said. How much do the methodologies really matter?
Right.
And I'm trying to find it in here where he says it. Okay. In reference to the volleyball coaching wizards and other top coaches, he says they all have a really clear vision and a detailed plan for achieving it. So our tendency is to focus on the second part, so methodology, as though that were replicable, easy word, and important in the first place. He says the important thing is the vision and its connection with the method. And those things, that combination of things, what he kind of describes as the person vision method blending of things is really, you can't replicate that because that's highly individual. And I made that comment. And we've had this discussion about, say, let's take service Eve. How much does it matter the exact training regimen you use to teach passing versus the fact that you spend a lot of time focused on passing?
Right.
Now, the scientists will tell you, okay, there's probably some marginal gain to be had. How much is hard to quantify if you're using more optimal methods.
Right.
As they relate to the group that you're working with, obviously. But to the degree that element is maybe offset by the fact that Coach A, whose team's passes better than Coach B, spends a little bit more time on coaching service Eve or in service Eve oriented exercises than Coach B, even if Coach B uses methods that you would argue are more optimal for skill development. That is, it's another one of those things of you'd have to go to a lot of gyms for a long time and take a lot of notes and measures and to try to suss that stuff out.
Yeah. And I mean, I really like what Mark said. I think that's a really good point, is we get so caught up in the methodologies that are used and not in tying everything together, the vision part of it. How you tied that into just even, it could even be service Eve philosophy, does the libero grab every ball that they can? Mm-hmm. Or do you always play these themes? And if you get caught up in a regimen of we always play these themes, when you have a libero that is a phenomenal passer, maybe you're limiting what your team is capable of performing based on the methodology instead of being like, wow, this kid's a really great passer. Why don't we just let them pass everything and forget about themes?
Right.
Obviously, you still want some system of communication to be involved so that we know, hey, which one of these are they not getting? But that's not about a technique necessarily. And even that, I think, just in the overall broader context of the game can be lost. Obviously we think there are better ways to pass in the way you hold hands and platforms and angles, but then you go and you watch some really good players and you see some variants, you see some commonalities. And I think this commonality is probably important when it comes to technique and methods. But you see so much variance that it's like, maybe it's not that my focus on technique or the individual methodology matters, but that maybe it matters less than other factors. And to tie that back to the overall conversation where we talk about competitiveness, I think that competitiveness matters, but maybe maybe it's not the individual competitiveness of your players that's the biggest or most important thing.
Right, it's the competitiveness within the context of your overall philosophy and vision
right.
and structure.
Right, do you need to be individually competitive, or do you just need a team that competes hard on the floor? And then how do you define what competing hard is? Is it them being angry after a loss, as angry as you are? Or is it the effort that they gave during the match? If you look at the end of a match and you realize that they gave their best effort, then I think you have a competitive team, whether or not they each individually are upset after the loss or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, we have to deal with the facts that players are all different, and how they're going to react to things are going to be different. And I don't know that I would want a team that was extremely angry or extremely upset about losing all the time.
Well, and that brings up, a comment that David made, David Delosier. He's been on here a few times, for those of you that don't know him.
Just once. Maybe you listened to him a few times.
Talking to me about his first year, as a grad assistant at the college level, and a ball dropped in a match between two of the players who needed one win for it. And, he said the players, like, everybody was just waiting for him to blow up on him. And he stood up and he talked about the situation and they went back to playing. He didn't think anything else of it. But he said on the drive home, those players were in his van and they were like, "Coach, we were really impressed that you didn't lose it on us in that match." And he's like, it's just an opportunity to learn. So we need to figure out our structure and our system. And I think sometimes the natural instinct for coaches is, to lose it because, ball never hits the ground, right? Versus, okay, why didn't they go for it? Was that a lack of communication? Was it truly a lack of effort, which case it needs to be addressed?
There's
that perception of the ball dropping as a lack of competitiveness and the players, and I don't think that's necessarily true unless that becomes a consistent issue.
Right, yeah. If it's a case of apathy,
right,
where the ball hits the floor and nobody looks at each other, nobody seems to care, then okay, you might have a problem with competitiveness. But if the ball hits the floor and two players are looking at each other and they're talking and trying to figure out who should, or one of them says, "I'll take that next time, that was my scene," or takes responsibility or whatever the case may be, then okay, that's a group that you don't need to yell at them. They understand we made a mistake. It's not a good thing. We're going to fix it. Let's move on. Now, if it's the apathy sort of thing, I don't know if screaming and yelling and punishing is going to make it any better.
Right.
Maybe that's never the answer. That's also a whole other topic of conversation. But it just makes the point we were kind of talking about at the beginning is how competitiveness can be expressed in a lot of different ways that may not be the overt "I hate to lose" thing that you hear from some. Michael Jordan famously would talk about how much he hated to lose. And he's not the only one, obviously. There's a lot of people like that. And to me, it's an interesting sort of mentality. And I've posted on this before. We've got two primary sources of motivation intrinsically. One being away from, which is that I hate losing. I don't want to lose. And the other one is toward. I love winning. Inherently, and this goes back to my behavioral finance PhD, inherently we are biased against losing. We do not like to give things up. And it gets expressed in a whole lot of ways. And you could read books and papers on this. It's just one of those psychological biases that we're kind of ingrained with. So from that perspective, the fear of losing and the drive not to lose makes sense. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the best way to go about things or the right attitude, you know, to try to take, because a lot of the biases that we have are counterproductive. Let's be honest.
Oh, are you trying to tell me that a confirmation bias isn't a good thing?
In a certain context, it probably benefits us quite a bit, which is why it developed in the first place.
Sure.
But in a different context?
I actually think one of the biggest benefits that confirmation bias has is confidence. Whether that's from the player or the coaching side of things, is you can project a whole lot of confidence when you're sure that you're right.
Oh, yeah. And there is research that backs up the idea of that overconfidence can actually lead to better performance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, over time, does that work? Maybe not, because if people start to realize you don't know what you're talking about, then their confidence in you might wane a little bit.
Right.
And you know, and rational people who are presented with sufficient evidence to counter their beliefs will eventually, you know, be forced to change those beliefs. But yeah, it's if the winning mentality, they're putting aside, okay, we've got the I don't want to lose mentality. But then if we look at it, say, okay, well, what can we use in the place of that? That's more of a toward motivation, toward winning. Is that strong enough? Is just simply winning strong enough motivation? We want to win to get it done. Just on the face of it, it seems weak to me. I get the fire of not losing. I mean, as I said, there's good research backing up why we want to be that way and how strong that motivation is. So if winning in and of itself is not enough, how do you make it stronger? What do you kind of have to build on it or add to it to make it stronger for those who want the toward motivation as opposed to the away from?
Well, I think that goes back to part of the whole experience, because it's not just winning from an individual sense for the motivation. It's not just that individual reward of winning, but it's part of the payoff of everything that they've done to put in with the group, with the people around them, with the players around them. So then that drive, I think, maybe gets exaggerated. Nope, that's not the word I'm looking for. It becomes more than just the individual desire to win when you put it in the context of what they've been striving for as an entire team. And I think that motivation is a little bit stronger.
Yeah, I would agree. Working on behalf of others versus just working for yourself. And now, not everybody's wired that way.
Right.
Let's be honest. I mean, you kind of expect that those who are more individually oriented probably are going to skew towards sports that have a bit more of an individual focus. And volleyball is not one of those sports. You need other people to do anything in volleyball, really. Unless you're a 13-year-old with a wicked serve.
Yeah.
Then you can go a long way as long as there aren't any restrictions.
Dear coach, today I served 25 aces. I would like to be on the national team.
But yeah, that doesn't last long. That doesn't last long. Even at the level, most people out there probably don't know. There's a player who plays right now for Vakif Bank under Giovanni Gaudetti. It's his opposite, Isabelle Hawk, who I think it's her second season right now with him. When I was in Sweden, I had a coach against her when she was like 16. Hmm. And she was the best player in the league. She was an opposite for the team that won the championship. They set her 50% of the time. She got 50% of the kills. But that's only 50%. The other 50% have to come from somewhere else. So as much as she was an awesome player and definitely influenced their success, she couldn't do it by herself. Somebody had to center the ball for her to get those kills, for example.
I mean, you could take the example when we were at Midwestern State and Division II Lone Star Conference, NCAA, pretty good conference overall. And the number one hitter in D2 played for one of the teams in the league, and they were good. And she earned almost half of their team's points. I think it was a very similar situation. But it wasn't just her. That it's a really good team around her supporting her earning points, where she wasn't the one earning those points.
Yeah. Yeah, we had this discussion. You looked at the teams. That was Tarleton, I'm assuming that you're talking about.
That was Tarleton and Haley Roberts.
Angelo was the other top team at that time. Commerce came on in a little bit after that and became a really good team. Commerce, the year I think they finished third in 2017. I don't think they had anybody in the first team. They might have done. They might have done. But they didn't have any stars at all.
They were definitely players. An even team split on their success.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, Angelo had All-American level players. Tarleton had All-American level players.
Right.
But they were strong in multiple positions. They weren't just it wasn't just that one player.
Right.
You know, so yeah, as much as you could, we got to limit them and reduce. If you let somebody else get the opportunity, they were going to kill you just as easily. So that was a crazy conference. I mean, probably still is. I will forever remember the time we went against Kingsville, and nobody played any defense. I think both teams in that set had over 20 kills. it was bananas.
The stats for that were up. You know, we had the hitting percentages and the whole list up on the whiteboard. That was always a fun one. When recruits would take them to the locker room and be like, oh, yeah, and then there's this game where everybody was on fire and we got lots of kills. No defense.
Nope.
With a lot of pass that kill.
Yeah, exactly. That was wacko. I mean, even in the middle of it, you're like, this is just completely insane. It was like watching men's volleyball. The rallies were so short. It was like that. Just bang, bang. All right. Well, let's try to wrap this topic up, I suppose. We're basically in agreement in terms of there are other ways of getting at being a good team without it having to necessarily be coming down to the individual level of competition felt by players.
I agree. And I'm not saying that competitiveness is not important. I do think that it matters that you have to have some individuals, some athletes with that drive on the team. I just think that we spend more time than necessary from what I've seen, and this could just be biased observations based on the gyms I've been around. I think that more time is spent trying to get athletes to be something that they don't need to be that would be more productive being spent elsewhere.
Thanks for listening. Check out the show notes on the website, coachingbb.com. for links and further information about this episode. You'll also be able to find the complete back catalog of prior coaching conversations. While you're there, you can sign up for my mailing list. Members find out in advance what conversations I'll be doing next and can submit questions if they like. If you'd like to support this podcast, go to patreon.com/coachingbb. Patrons get early access to every episode, as well as other special benefits along the way. I'm always interested in hearing what you think about coaching conversations and ideas you might have of topics and or guests for future episodes. You can send them to me at john@coachingbb.com, tweet them to @coachingbb, or hit me up on my Facebook page, Coaching Volleyball. All the best until next time.